My pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Alonzo B. from Los Angeles.
Thank you, sir. Hi, my name's Alonzo. I'm an alcoholic. And congratulations to all the birthday people. And I have to say, that was just actually kind of funny to me to just watch people celebrate their birthday and you just come up and just say your date and you got to sit down. And where I'm from, we'd never shut up that quick. That's I don't know, admirable, I guess. I don't know. It's one of those things, and I guess it's kind of, and I'll get into this in my story, but one of the things that's kind of a gift for me is I travel a lot, and I get to see AA in a lot of different places and the different ways that they do. Like, we do the same thing in a lot of different ways, you know, and it's kind of cool. So this is just one more thing that I'm saying that's just like, all right, that's cool, you know. So getting to my story, and I don't know if I'm supposed to give my sobriety date because I noticed other people did. So mine is 3/15/88. So I've been sober 19 years. And what's cool is the first speaker, I think his name was Paul. His sobriety date's June 13th, and that's my natal birthday. So I thought that was kind of funny that, you know, both days are mine. That's right. He's living on my day. So anyway, what it was like, the drinking portion of my life, and I've absolutely learned this in AA, is nothing spectacular. You know, I am an alcoholic. I don't know if there's such thing as garden variety alcoholic, but I don't have one of those phenomenal stories that I hear some people have gone through. You know, I started getting loaded when I was 13. And the reason I did it was because the older guys did it and they were cool. So I wanted to be like them. So I started doing it. But the one alcoholic trait that I've always had from the very start is I've always liked getting loaded alone. I always preferred to get loaded alone. So even back then, like, you know, we would pitch in like whatever money you had and then see how much we could get. You know, so could we get beer or could we get beer and booze or beer and booze and weed or whatever. It all depended on how much money we had on any given day. But I would always hold back a little so that I would have like a beer and a joint. And late at night when I would walk the dog, I would get loaded by myself. As a friend of mine describes it, I had to relieve the everyday tensions of a 13-year-old. You know, but that was the truth. The truth was, I just liked it. You know, I liked it from the start, and it worked. And it worked for a long time. You know what I mean? Like through school, I did great in school. I was getting loaded, but I was having a good time. I went to a school called Aviation High School in New York, and besides the regular high school curriculum, we also trained to be airplane mechanics. So we had like the regular five periods of, you know, English, math, social studies, science, whatever, and then we would have 3 to 4 periods more of shop, which is when we would study and learn airplanes. Now, my thing was, I didn't care about the regular classes because those were just required, and I did care about shop, and I was good at school. So I did well enough to pass in the regular classes, and I kind of excelled in the shop program. And I remember this teacher saying to me, she was like, you know, if you applied yourself, you could really do great in all your classes. And I was like, yeah, I know, but I can coast and pass. Why would I want to put in any more work than that, you know? And this is something I've learned in sobriety. My philosophy toward life has always been, tell me what's required of me so I can do it and then tell you to leave me alone. You know, that was my thing. I wanted you to leave me alone. So all you had to do was tell me, what do you need so I can do it and then leave me alone. So as far as those classes, that was my attitude. I do good enough to pass, you leave me alone. Now the shop program, they had something I wanted, so I focused and excelled in that, and I would never, you know, I wouldn't screw that up. So anyway, I graduated from high school and I was in the top 50. See, two licenses are required to fix an airplane. You have to have a airframe license and a power plant license. And the way the school worked was you get one license in your senior year. Then the top 50 students were invited to come back and get the second license. And that really saved you a lot of money, because otherwise you'd have to go to college for it or whatever, cost you a lot of money. So anyway, I was invited to come back. I came back, I got the second license, and I was offered a job in LA working for Lockheed. Now the thing was, I was only 17 because I had graduated from high school early. So I did all of this paperwork to get the job, and at some point the recruiter said, wait a minute, you're only 17. I was like, yeah, I know, I got a schooler. He's like, well, you can't work for us until you're 18. So I went home and I told my dad, I was like, look, I got a job waiting, so for the next 6 months, I'm off. I'm not doing nothing, and by law, you have to let me live here. You know, that was just kind of the relationship we had through my teenage years. And that's what I did, and it was a six-month party, and it was great. I had this great job. I worked at a catering place, and, you know, we did weddings and dinner dances and stuff like that. Well, the great thing about the job was free booze. You know, like after the party, we could grab pitchers of beer or whatever, and we get drunk and hang out. So for me, perfect job, you know, and me and my dad used to fight and argue and stuff like that, but now I had it. I was like, I got my freedom. I'm just counting down days, you know. So for my 18th birthday, my dad gave me a trunk to pack my stuff and a one-way ticket to LA. And it's cool, you know, because what happened was, as far as I was concerned, like, it was time for me to go. You know, it wasn't a bad thing. I felt like, yeah, I'm a man. I got to get out of here. I got to start my life and so on. So I left. I went to California, and for me, the party just continued. This place, Lockheed, hired somewhere between 400 and 600 graduates from my high school. So we're all out in California now, but now we all have these good jobs. And to us, it's just like school. Like, what, we fixing airplanes? That's what we've learned to do. And we were having a great time, and now it was like, now the party really starts, because now we're making money. You know, and all the things start coming together, you know, the apartment and the cars and the stereos and the TVs and, of course, the partying on the weekends and stuff. And this was in 1980. And as you know, in the early 80s, cocaine was not addicting. It was just a little something for the weekend. And I don't say that in any disrespect to this being an AA meeting. I say that because it is part of my story. And believe me, I'll tell you where I'm at with that. When I got sober, I went to a place called Studio 12, and it was a recovery house, and they had all kind of meetings, but mainly it was AA meetings and CA meetings, and the same people would be at all the meetings. So when I got sober, I never learned any difference between an alcoholic and an addict. In my mind, to me, it's the same thing, and I certainly feel I qualify on both fronts. So when I talk about that, again, it's in no disrespect to this being an AA meeting. I'm just telling you my story, and this was part of it. So if you did drugs, you can relate. If you didn't do drugs and you just did alcohol, only listen to that half. So anyway, so now, you know, it's I'm young and the party's going and life is working for me. See, this is the thing. I always, and again, I learned this and I look back in retrospect, I lived what I called a charmed life. Nothing went wrong for me. I had the jobs, I had the education, now I had a better job, I'm living life, and things are good, you know? And then I decided I needed her. Like, that was the next thing I needed. I needed her. And I met this girl, and, you know, it looked like her, and it smelled like her, and it tasted like her, it sounded like her, and it wasn't her. It wasn't even close to being her. But at the time, it was her. And what happened, that was the first year in my life that I can remember anything like big going wrong. You know, the first thing that happened was I got laid off from Lockheed. Now, I was in my early 20s now. I was like 21, 22. I hadn't been out of work since I was 15. I worked all through high school, and I had this job. So losing my job was a major thing. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. What I found out was because I was young and I was trained and I had experience, I was highly employable. I had another job in like 2 weeks. Like, I had multiple job offers. So in my mind, losing a job would never again be a problem, you know, because I got this, you know. And then I took a job in Santa Barbara, and I would go to Santa Barbara during the week and come back home to LA on weekends. And I came back one weekend And by now, she and I are living together. You know, we moved in together within a month because, you know, it's an alcoholic relationship, and that's what we do. So anyway, I came home, and she was gone. And everything was gone. Like, she moved out, took the car, furniture, everything. I literally came home to carpet, you know, which it's funny now. At the time, it was devastating. And the reason was I had never learned to deal with feelings. I never felt anything. I like getting loaded. I like not feeling. What happened was, and I want to be real clear about this, that wasn't when I became an alcoholic or an addict or anything else, but that was when I stopped caring about anything else because I wanted the pain to go away. I wanted to numb that pain, and the only thing that would numb the pain was getting loaded. So all of those rules I lived by as a, you know, quote, functional alcoholic or functioning alcoholic, however you want to put it, all that went out the window. You know, now paying the Visa bill was not more important than getting loaded. Paying the rent wasn't more important than getting loaded. I had the same car repossessed 3 times in 1 year, you know, which tells you about the ingenuity of an alcoholic because I also got that car back 3 times in 1 year. We're creative when we're out there. And anyway, and what I stopped caring. All my rules, all of the things I was never going to do, I now did. You know, I was never going to get loaded at work. Now, I didn't care. I got loaded at work, you know, and the credit went, and I gave up my apartment, and I just stayed with friends on weekends. And I got into this life, we call it job shopping in aerospace business. And basically what it is, it was like being a temporary worker on airplanes, because different airlines and different companies have various reasons for needing a large number of mechanics for a short time. Like if a plane has what we call a hard landing, you guys call it a crash, but you're not trained. We're professionals. We say hard landing. But planes have accidents on the ground, and they need someone to fix them. And I got involved in doing this. And for an alcoholic in where I was, the job was perfect because they financed my geographics. Okay, for anyone who doesn't know what a geographic is, it's when I move away, trying to get away from my problems, not realizing that I am the problem and I'm taking me there. You know, but I was running from me. So I started bouncing around the country working on airplanes, and it was great. It was great. You know, if you had come to me at that time and said, Alonzo, you're an alcoholic, you're an addict, I'd have been, yes, and it's working out perfectly. I love being an alcoholic because, I mean, you know, all we had to do was fix the plane, and they kind of turned a blind eye to what else we did. You know, they knew we were partying all the time when we weren't at work, but they didn't care as long as you showed up and you did your work every day. And because, you know, and we were good at what we did. I was very good at what I did. And again, I learned this in sobriety. You know why I was a good airplane mechanic? Because I had to be. Because if I didn't work as an airplane mechanic, I couldn't get loaded. That's where I made my money to get loaded. Therefore, whatever it is in my brain, however that works, something told me, man, you better be good at fixing these airplanes. And I was. I excelled at it. I also led that double life. I was a liar and I was good at it. I literally led, like at work, I was a golden boy. I was in my early 20s. They made me like the lead man. They like put me in charge of this crew of airplane workers. I had people working for me who had been fixing planes before I was born. And they were cool with it because I knew how to finesse that. You know, I knew how to manipulate it and get them to work with me and this and that. So I'm doing that. But at the same time, I'm selling dope to guys who I work with, you know, and I did it. My lie was so, like, it was so entrenched that when one guy tried to get me busted and went to the bosses and said, you know, Alonzo's doing this, that, and the other, they got rid of him for creating problems. Seriously, he got fired because they were like, we don't need this trouble on the job. Everything's going fine. People like Alonzo. We're going to let him work. And it worked, you know. And then we went to Puerto Rico. This is something I never want to forget, and I'll explain why. We were rebuilding a plane in Puerto Rico. Now, sometimes you'll hear somebody in a meeting say, you know, my worst day sober is better than my best day loaded. Okay, that's not true for me. When we were in Puerto Rico, we were living in a condo on the beach. We were dating showgirls from the hotel next door. We literally had champagne, cocaine, and cash, and alcoholism was working. It was working quite well at that moment. And this is why I always want to remember this. And one, because for fun, we would throw dope on the floor and watch people look for it. You know, because we had it like that, you know, and that was funny to us. And the reason I always want to remember that is because about 9 months later, on a job in Oakland, I was looking for that piece of dope on the floor. See, I never want to forget how that changed, because once it changed, it never went back. As things got worse, they never got better again. They would get worse. So, you know, I left Puerto Rico, went to Oakland, worked the job in Oakland. That job ended, went to Dallas, do it again. And it's just a cycle. I'm just going places, doing a job, getting loaded. The job ends. I keep getting loaded. The money runs out. I get another job. I move somewhere else. This is how I lived for a couple of years. When I got to Dallas, I bottomed and I had nowhere to go. And I called my mother and I asked for help. And it was the first time I asked for help. And I told her about the drug thing. And I said, I'm stuck. I don't have any money. I don't know what to do. And she wired me money to go back to LA. And the same day she sent me the money, a buddy called and he was driving across the country. And he said, if I helped him drive, I could throw my stuff in the truck and head back to LA. Now, the minute I hung up that phone, I didn't have a problem. I dodged a bullet one more time. So the money my mother sent me, I got loaded one more time, and we headed back to LA. I got my old job back at Lockheed and started the cycle again. But what happened was, after about 3 or 4 months, I was going to get fired for missing work, because Lockheed paid on Thursday. And if you pay an alcoholic on Thursday and expect me to show up on Friday, that's just not going to happen. But they also had this big, like, within the company, they had this employee assistance program, and they would send you to rehab and the whole bit, you know. And to us, it was just a scam. It was just something you do. You go in, you say, I got a problem, and they send you to some rehab. And you could do it 3 times before you actually got fired, because it was considered a medical condition. So that was my plan, you know. It's like, okay, I'll play along. I'll pretend I got this problem. I'll go do their little rehab thing, and then, you know, it'll all go away. And that was my plan. And I went and to the rehab place, and they told me I had to give up everything. And I was like, you don't understand. I have a minor problem smoking cocaine. I'm okay with everything else. And they were like, no, you have to give it all up. And that wasn't going to work, because I wasn't there to get sober. I was there to keep a job. And I lasted 2 weeks, and I started getting loaded, and the cycle took off one more time. And one more time, I got lucky in that Lockheed laid me off. Because it was always better to get laid off than get fired, because when you're laid off, your record's clean. So I'm about to go on the road again. Same cycle, do it all again. What happened was I got busted. I'd been lucky. I'd never been arrested, never got caught. I got busted. When they put me in the back of the police car and I had the handcuffs on, I remembered that word powerless. That was all I remembered. Because you guys had told me I was powerless, and when you told me that, I didn't believe you. I didn't. Intimidation was one of my tools when I was out there. I couldn't be powerless. I'd make people do what I wanted them to do. I could scare people. I could threaten people. I could manipulate people. You told me I was powerless. You're crazy. You know? And then when I was in the back of that police car wearing those handcuffs, realizing whatever happens next has nothing to do with me. At this moment, my life is totally out of my control and certainly not what I had planned. And I knew what you meant. And what happened was, that's when I became willing. And that was on a Saturday. The Sunday, I got drunk, because I didn't know what else to do. I got out of jail, obviously. I didn't know what to do. The Monday, I went back to the rehab place the job had sent me to, and I talked my way back in. And I've been sober ever since. And I think willingness was the key. So I went back to this rehab place, and I'm going to outpatient rehab, and they had a panel come in. And on this panel, one night, this panel came in, there was this girl who was just beautiful, girl on the panel. Now, I don't know what she talked about. You know, she's rambling on about sobriety. You know how you people get, you know. All excited and happy and blah, blah, blah. I didn't hear any of that. All I knew was she was hot and she was from New York. And I was from New York, and I had probably well over a week of sobriety. So I'm obviously what she's been waiting for, you know. And what's funny is, with time, I find out how much that's true. At the time, I didn't know. But anyway, Women like, hey, hey, that's a low blow. Don't worry about it. But anyway, so after they spoke, I went up to her, and she was so funny because she knew exactly what I was up to. And she's like, look, I'm married, but there are a lot of women like me that go to this place called Studio 12. And I was like, I don't know where it is, but it is now my home group. I'm joining. And I met her there, and she introduced me to this guy, and she said, he's going to be your sponsor, and, you know, have a seat. And I love these guys at Studio 12 because I walked into the exact group of guys I needed to meet. I met the guys who said, sit down, shut up, and listen. You're a newcomer. You don't know a damn thing. We're going to tell you what to do, and you're going to do it. And I needed that. Now, I've learned in my sobriety that approach doesn't work for everyone. Some people need a much more gentle approach. Some people need like an educational approach, a loving approach, et cetera, et cetera. I needed that approach. I needed guys who saw right through me. These guys, they'd literally be like, you're lying. We know you're lying because we told the same lies. They're like, you start the lie, we'll finish the lie. We know your game. I told you, intimidation was my game. Right away, they introduced me to a bunch of guys who had been in prison, and then they introduced me to a guy who'd been on death row. You know, now I might be intimidating in the valley. You know, I'm cool in Sherman Oaks, but you've been to San Quentin, then you win. I'm not intimidating anymore. I'm gonna listen to what you have to say. And that's the way it was. And that was the other thing. Those guys laughed at me. They laughed, because I was angry. You know, I mean, I was willing. I wanted to stay sober. But I'm going to tell you, the willingness, there are a lot of days when it would be 51% willingness and 49% I'm out of here, you know. But and I would be angry. And there were times when I would come in and I'd stand at the back of the room and I'd just be mad. And they would laugh at me. They found it hilarious. I'd show up late, they would stop the meeting and give me a round of applause. They'd be like, he made it. And they would tell me what to do. And that was a big thing. When I was new, they were all about action. That's what they told you. It's all about action. They told me to do things, and they never told me why. And I wouldn't know the lesson until after I did it. And we would discuss this, because I had other newcomer friends. We came in together. And it was weird, because it was like my sponsor would be nice to me, but his friends could pick on me. And then my friend, his sponsor would be nice to him, but my sponsor could pick on him. It was a weird kind of dynamic, but it was really cool because it worked. And one of the things they told us, they said, once you get a year, you get to do this to other people. And I was like, oh, you better believe I'm going to be here because, you know. But anyway, they would tell us what to do. So one night I'm getting a cup of coffee and they said, you're the coffee person. And I was like, you don't understand, because I was new, and that was usually my opening line. You don't understand. First of all, I don't know how to make coffee. Second of all, what if I got something to do on Saturday night? And they said, okay, first of all, we're going to show you how to make coffee. You're new. You don't know how to do anything. And second of all, what you have to do on Saturday night is be here an hour early, because the coffee better be ready when we get here. And then they would leave, because they never stuck around for my rebuttal. So now I'm looking around, I'm like, I don't know, and I, you know, you then discuss it with my boys, like, I gotta make coffee. Yeah, you gotta make coffee. Why? They said, blah, 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 blah. So now I'm making coffee, right? But here's what they didn't tell me. First of all, they didn't tell me that because I was there an hour early every week, I met everyone at the meeting. I was forced to get to know people because I like getting loaded alone. I'm not a social person. I don't like you because it's easier for me to not like you and push you away than to risk you getting to know me. But now I'm here for an hour early. I have to meet these people. I have to talk to these people. The other thing was the meeting was a book study. So in the course of my 6-month commitment, I would go through the entire book. That's how they taught me. They didn't say this is why you have the commitment. They just told me to do it. You know, there were a bunch of other benefits from it, obviously. There was another thing that happened, and these are things I'll never forget. They had a row of chairs, like right up front, wooden chairs, and they called that death row. And that's where the newcomers would sit. And Tom, the guy who ran the place, Tom had this beautiful disdain for newcomers. Like he cared about you, but he treated you as if you would get it on him, you know? So this girl, this woman was moving, and she told Tom she was moving, and he looks over and he's like, any of you got a driver's license? And you know, I had done my community service, so I had a license. So I'm like, I got a license. He's like, all right, you're gonna drive the truck and the rest of you are gonna lift the furniture. You'll be here Saturday at 9 o'clock. And he looked at her and said, and don't give them money because they're new. They'll just get loaded. Give them a pizza. And he walked away. And we discussed it amongst ourselves as we do it. What do? We got to be here? No, you ain't got to be here. You got to be here. He said to be here. We'll be here. I'm going to be here. You're going to be here? Yeah, we're going to be here. So, you know, because when you're new, there's a lot of late nights and coffee, and you discuss things. And this is what we did. And we showed up Saturday, and we moved her. And the next week, he had another one, and we moved that one. And the next week, it was another one. And we got so good at it, we were like, all we need to know, where you leaving, where you going? We got it. We'll take it from here. You rent the truck because we don't have any credit cards, but we will handle your move. Now, what Tom didn't tell me, what he didn't tell us, was first of all, we were working. We were learning to work again. We were going to be tired at the end of the day, so we wouldn't be up all night. We'd go to bed on the weekend. We'd get some sleep. But what he really didn't tell me was that I would be forming lifelong friendships, that because we were new together and we spent all our time together, we bonded on an incredible level to where in October, my friend Marlon turned 20. And next week, my friend Ava used to cook and feed us and stuff, and Ava is one of the closest people in the world to me. She'll be 20 next week. And Brian will be 20 in January, and I'll be 20 in March. We're still friends, we still talk. When Brian, thank you. My friend Brian lives in Slidell, Louisiana. When Hurricane Katrina hit, he got in touch with me and Ava in California, and it was like, what do you need? What can we do? We don't see each other regularly. We don't, you know, but that's the kind of friendship we have. When Ava got married, when she had her kid, I was at the hospital that night to keep her crazy stepmother calm so she could have a baby in peace. You know, I literally, my job was keep stepmom calm so her and her husband could, you know, be in there and deliver the baby, and I get to do things like this. Her daughters are my nieces. That's what, they know me as their uncle. I love them. I spoil them to death. The biggest gift in my sobriety, I have three nieces and a nephew. I've been sober their whole life. They range in age from 3 up to 18. The oldest one, my sister's oldest daughter, just started college. I've been sober their whole life. That's all they know. They know me as an uncle who shows up. They know me as an uncle who spoils them ridiculously. They ask me for, and their parents have taught them to ask me for stuff. You need something? Well, you need to talk to Uncle Alonzo. He's rich. And I get to do that, and it's the most phenomenal thing in the world. And I get to talk to the older ones about drugs and alcohol and tell them the mistakes I made in hopes that they avoid it. And I've had moments, and a long time ago someone told me that, you know, a lot of it is about moments. And there's things that I will never forget, gifts that I've been given here. When my nephew was 7 and he was starting Little League, I was playing catch with him in front of the house, and I was nearly crying because it hit me in that moment that you guys took an alcoholic and an addict, and you made him a hero to a 7-year-old kid. And that's all that mattered in that moment. And when my niece was 16 and I went to visit her at high school, and this is when her and my sister were fighting the way me and my father used to fight. You know, I drove up and I heard her say to her friend, she's like, yeah, that's my uncle and he's my best friend. So I had to drive around the corner so she didn't see her uncle crying, because I get those gifts as long as I stay sober. Because one of the things they taught me when I was new, they said, as long as you stay sober, you get these things. If you get loaded, then you make a conscious decision to give up everything in your life. So far, I haven't had to make that decision to give up these kids. And the kids mean a lot to me, but I also get other gifts. Not too long ago, I was working on this cruise, and I got to take my parents on the cruise. And that was, you know, that's a gift. That's a sobriety thing. See, and I made my amends to my parents a long time ago, not in detail, but gave them an idea of what I had done and what it had been like. And this, and my mother was like, look, I don't understand. I don't know what all this AA stuff is about. I just know I don't have to worry about you anymore. So when I get to take them on a cruise, that's AA working. That's something I get to give back to them. That's my way of saying thank you for bailing me out a million times back when I was using, drinking, and in trouble. That's my way of saying I'm okay now. And while we're on the cruise, my father tells me it's their 49th anniversary. And I said, look, I already bought you a cruise. Now stop begging, you're embarrassing me. Just leave it alone. Because we do get to laugh today. Now this laughter, and I gotta talk about this. See, when I was new, these guys laughed at me until I could laugh at myself. I always had a sense of humor, but my sense of humor was used to make you smaller so I felt bigger. It was used to tear you down so I felt better about me. They laughed at me until I could laugh at myself. I was working, training airplane mechanics. I said, man, I want to be a comic because I could make the people laugh. And they were like, you can do this. I was like, how? They were like, we have no idea. But you can do this. And I tried it. I took this comedy writing class and I did my first show and I loved it. And one of these guys who had picked on me from the first day I came in came up to me and said, look, I think we finally found out what God meant for you to do. Now that happened at 5 years sober. When we say don't leave before the miracle happens, we mean it. I don't know what your miracle is. I don't know how long it's going to take. I implore you to stay and give it a chance. My comedy career has been beyond anything I could have imagined. I've traveled around the world numerous times. You know, I have all the material stuff and the toys, and I love that stuff. My God knows I like that stuff. He's like, Alonzo is a whiny, materialistic guy. We need to give him new stuff every now and then just so he'll leave people alone. And I get that. And I get to enjoy it. And my sponsor, who is also a materialistic guy, I always tell this story because I'm going to tell you how this program works and how life works. When I was new, Daryl, who's my sponsor now, he always drove Porsches. And I was like, man, I want a Porsche. And Daryl's a little fat guy. And Daryl said, man, I want to be tall and thin. We don't always get what we want around here. At 9 years sober, I bought a Porsche. And I drove to a meeting. And Daryl was there in a Ferrari. And the people laughing here now know exactly what I'm talking about. It's something about sponsors. Every time you think you got something on them, they remind you, nope, I'm still better than you. But you know, another thing that happened, and this is, again, learned by how people live and what they do, there was a few years back, me and Daryl were, you know, weren't working. We just couldn't hustle up enough work. And he sold the Ferraris, and I sold the Porsche. And it was like, you know something, they're toys. They come and go. It's not the most important thing in the world. It doesn't define who I am. It's just nice to have when I can have it. You know, so... He didn't just say it, I watched him do it, and I did it, and, you know, we survived. It's not that big a deal, but it's nice. And if you're new here and any spiritual giant comes up to you and says, oh, material things don't matter, you just say, give me your car right now. Give me the car, because it don't matter to you, but I hate the bus. And then they come down off the mountain and they talk. It's good. So that's where my life is in those areas. It's phenomenal. In the area of family, I'm blessed and my life is phenomenal. In the area of career, my life is phenomenal. The toughest part of my sobriety and the toughest thing for me is my emotional sobriety. My emotional sobriety has been a tough road. It's been a slow road because it was one I did not want to work on. You know, remember, I told you from a long time ago, I didn't know how to do feelings. You know, I joke with the women in this program. I owe a debt to the women of this program that I'll never be able to repay because it was the women in this program who allowed me to feel and who taught me what feelings were. Because when you're a big, intimidating guy, and men tend to bond on a different level, you know, and it's a man-to-man thing, and it's certainly not going to be a how do you feel today kind of, you know, not in the beginning. You get to that point, but in the beginning it's not. And, you know, we talk about sports, and we hang out. And me and this guy used to work out together, and we'd be angry, and we'd go to the gym. Because that was the only emotion I knew when I came in here was anger, and everything translated to anger. Well, women got past that right away. They were like, oh, you know, knock it off. I'm not scared of you. You're a big teddy bear. How do you really feel? And they would allow me to feel. And I think women have a natural gift for that. I think it's like almost a maternal instinct or something. I don't know, I'm no expert, but that has been my experience. And it was a beautiful thing. So women helped me a lot in this area. Well, I got into this relationship when I had 10 years sober, and then I started cheating on one girl with another girl, and we were all in the program, and it was a very small world, and it was bad. It was very bad. You know, I laugh about it now. I said, I'll never get in a relationship. I got into two. But, you know, but at the time, it was terrible, and it was painful for everybody involved. And I asked Daryl to sponsor me at that time, and he said, yeah, I'm glad you asked, because you were on your way out. And I didn't realize it at the time, but now in retrospect, I probably was, because my behavior and everything I was doing was just so, I don't know, toxic, for lack of a better word. You know, I was living a lie and chasing another person living a lie and blah, blah, blah. It was just messy. But anyway, we got to work one more time on the steps. And we got to work. I got to work on the steps, just totally on a spiritual basis to ease the pain, to provide some comfort, and on an emotional basis, because he said my problem was I never developed a relationship with myself. He said you have to have a relationship with yourself before you can have a relationship with other people. And we worked on this, and things happened that were amazing. You know, one thing that happened was, when I was going through it really bad, this woman said to me, she said, you know, it's kind of good you're going through this, because a lot of guys in this program look up to you, and if you're going through it, it will allow them to go through it. And I was like, well, why did I have to be the guinea pig? Why couldn't I watch one of them go through it? But again, in retrospect, she was right. She was right. And guys came up to me and said, man, you know, I want to talk to you about blah, blah, blah. And it was something that I had been through. I went through pain that I had never felt. I went through pain that I had never allowed myself to feel. I was crying once in a meeting to where, like, I couldn't breathe. And my friend Sue just held me. And all she kept saying was, I'll never let you go. I'll never let you go. And what I learned in that is this is something we will do. We will love you through it. We don't necessarily know what the answer is, what the solution is. But we will love you through the problem. And that's what Sue did that particular day. And that happens here in this program all the time. If you take a chance on us, we'll go to any lengths to help you get through that day. That's what we do around here. And I got to experience receiving that. You know, and the forgiveness that happened with this thing, the girl who I hurt so badly, one of her dreams in life was to get married and have a family. And she did. You know, a few years later, she got married, she got pregnant, and she called me the day she had the baby to tell me she had a baby and how happy she was and everything was okay. Now, that's a level of forgiveness I can't comprehend, because I did terrible things to her. But she forgave me on that level. And the other girl involved, we've since made amends and recovered that relationship. And it's, you know, it's cool now. You know what I mean? And the whole thing healed, and it took a long time, and it took a lot of work, but it did happen. Now, I'm not fixed. I'm not cured or anything on the emotional level. I don't have it down. I'm no guru, but I'm a lot better than I was. I'm a lot better, and I know it's an area that I have to work on. There are times when I do work on it, and I'm improving. My mind is a lot more open to things it wasn't open to before. There are a lot of things that I used to be like, oh, you're crazy. What are you talking about? Now I'm like, oh, let me listen to that. Maybe I can learn something. You know, and this happened at 10 years of sobriety. See, now I'm not recommending that. But I'm saying that even after a long term of sobriety, I'm not well. I'm not fixed. I'm not cured. I still have problems, and I still have to deal with them, you know? And it's okay now. I'm okay with that now. Today, on a day-to-day basis, my life is phenomenal. My life is great. I still have to deal with my head. You know, I was talking with Mike and Steph last night, I'm doing this thing in the Mandalay Bay Hotel for Pepsi Cola, and it, you know, it's a big deal, big corporate party and blah blah blah, and they're treating me like I'm great and this and that, and you know, life is good, except that a friend of mine, I keep seeing this banner flashing that he's performing at the events arena, and my head is like, I'm nothing. I am absolutely nobody. There's no banner flashing with my name. I am worthless. You know, and you know what that is? That's an alcoholic. That's my head. That's my head shifting in any given moment. That's why I have to come to meetings like this. That's why I have to talk to friends. That's why I have to laugh at myself. You know, when my sponsor is great for whenever I complain, he's like, really? Well, let's talk about 5 years ago. Let's talk about this. And I'm like, you know something? Shut up. And he's so good that a lot of times, and he doesn't just do this to me, he doesn't even say anything. He just gives me that look. You know, because sponsors will do that. They give you that look, and you're like, you know something? Shut up. And you didn't have to say that. And I'm like, yeah, you're another one. You know, but we have a great relationship, and we get to laugh. And I still laugh a lot in this program. If you're new here, we will laugh at you. We enjoy your problems. Tell them to us, we'll crack up. You won't understand. You'll think it's the end of the world and wonder why we're laughing. We're laughing because we know if you stay sober, you're going to get through that problem, you're going to hear it from someone else, and you're going to get to laugh at them. That's what we do. We get through this if we stick around. I've been through some horrible things here. The guy who helped me so much when I was new, the guy who used to point and laugh at me and stuff when I came in, he died in a murder-suicide. He was loaded, and he killed someone and killed himself. You know, that kind of thing happens around here. There are terrible things that happen around here, but there are also great things that happen around here. And we are a society of people. So if you're new here and you hear the negative side of AA, the gossip in AA, the inappropriate relationships in the AA, the he said, she said, the this, the that, it's all true. Every bit of it. It's absolutely true. You know why? Because we're human. And anytime you put humans together, that kind of thing is going to happen. But here's the difference. If you say, man, I want to have a drink, all that stuff falls away. And the most important thing becomes you not having a drink. And the person who was talking about you or you were talking about or you hate or they hate, or whatever, that person will help you. That person will sit with you, talk to you, take you to a meeting, do whatever. Because we know what it's like to have to drink. I know what it's like to have to drink, not to want to drink, not to get drunk from drinking, not to get loaded, to absolutely have to drink and have no control and no power of my own to stop me. I know how that feels. Every alcoholic in this room knows how that feels. And we will help you through that moment. All we ask is that you give us a chance to help you. All we ask is that you tell us. Tell us you feel like a drink. Don't go home with that feeling. It's the holidays. Tell us you feel lonely. Tell us you're mad. Tell us you hate Christmas. You hate New Year's, whatever. We'll hate it with you. We'll go kick an elf's ass. We don't care. We'll stay sober today. We're not drinking. We're laughing. We're having a good time because we are sober today. Hang out with us. Give it a chance. And thank you for letting me share.